Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
There was a little drawing of a harp next to that, followed by an exclamation mark. The back of his was covered in stuff like, Brian is not a very nice guy, but Alex is so nice. And that had an exclamation thing too. It was just silly crap. He hit the spot. And he let himself be drawing.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. This week's guest is half of one of the world's greatest electronic bands, but that doesn't really do them justice. Their beats are great, but their lyrics form an essential part of their music, and their anthems can fill a club dance floor, but their albums move the mind as much as the feet. They're also as much of a live spectacle as any rock band. My guest on the first time this week is from Underworld, Carl Hyde.
Sweet in winter, sweet in rain, shake well before you, she said. You never touch me.
Here, Carl looks back at the start of his musical history, his early passions growing up in Worcester, and his first gigs and influences. He also talks about meeting his future Underworld partner Rick Smith, and their search to find a creative identity, first in post-punk bands like the Screen Gems, then in the new romantic outfit Frur, who would provide him and Carl with their first hit and their first taste of fame. He also discusses Underworld's early shows and how they became the acclaimed outfit they are today, taking in the iconic Born Slippy, which has its roots in Carl's own issues with alcohol abuse, all the way to soundtracking the 2012 Olympic opening ceremony. And now, onto their new album, Barbara Barbara, We Face a Shining Future. He also chooses some brilliantly eclectic and surprising music, like John Martin, Clifford T. Ward, and Prince. But I started by asking, as I do with all my guests, when was Carl first aware of music?
Very first time I was aware of music would be on the radio. It would be the Light programme, the BBC Light programme. And it would have been in the kitchen or on the radio. No, we couldn't afford a radio in the car in those days, so it would have been in the kitchen. Things like It's a Bitty Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini, the original. Of course, darling, you know, featuring Jimi Hendrix. It was an itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini that she wore for the first time today. An itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini, so in the locker she wanted to stay. Things like Joe Meek stuff and also weirdy reverby stuff like Big John.
Big John. Every morning at the mine you could see him arrive. He stood 6'6" and weighed 245, kind of broad at the shoulder and narrow at the hip. And everybody knew you didn't give no lip to Big John.
Big John. And the family favourites programmes, the BBC Family Favourites, which were the Forces kind of link-up, then they'd always play the same things over and over again. Sparky's Magic Piano comes round again. And it was quite often weirdy stuff. But in a way, kids were always fed this spooky, weird stuff.
Yeah.
So there you go. I grew up on spooky, weird stuff, courtesy of the BBC.
Sparky, oh, Sparky.
Who's that? Who's calling me?
It is I, your piano.
My piano? But you're talking.
Yes, I can talk.
Were you drawn to it? Were you in tune with this sound emanating from this radio?
Yeah, I was, because where we lived was, it wasn't very exciting. It was right out in the sticks, west of Birmingham, towards the Welsh border. So for me at that time, there was nothing going on there, nothing of any interest. The most exciting thing was the radio.
That's a great advert, folks, and just so love your radio.
It was a lifeline.
Yeah.
What was your first single?
The first single that I was gifted, it was my 10th birthday. My dad, as was often the case, would bring music into the house. And he bought me a record player, which I still have.
Oh.
Yeah, I do, yeah. And it's turquoise, lovely, with a seat on top. I can't quite work out how that works. But he bought me the Four Tops, Build Me Up Buttercup, and the Gun, Race with the Devil. So it kind of really messed me up. I never really, from then on, knew which way to go.
Better run, better run.
What about taking your money to Woolworths?
So the first thing would be an album, because I remember my dad saying, well, if you're going to spend all that money, son, get an album, because it's better value for money.
He's right.
And I bought Simon and Garfunkel's Parsley, Sage, Rosemary and Thyme, because I just loved the Scarborough Fair harmonies, this kind of peal of harmonies that they did still. It's fantastic.
Parsley, sage, rosemary.
But I like these cascading clouds of harmonies that they did. And at that time, I remember going to Kidderminster Market. And I said, oh, can I have an album with Scarborough Fair on? And they said, there are loads, mate. And I think there were about five out that week. But we nailed which one it was.
Tell her to reap it in a sickle mill of blazing in scarlet battalion. Parsley, sage, rosemary and
thyme. Another first has to be live music experience.
Yeah.
You know, whether that's a gig or whether a concert you were taken to as a kid. Yeah. I guess they're two kind of different questions.
Yeah, and that's emblazoned on my head. It's the Groundhogs. I was 14 years old. Me and my mate Mont, we went to the Birmingham Town Hall. We queued up with all the heads and their Petunia Oil Combats with their freak flags flying. And I can remember every band that was on there. It was like 10 shillings. It was three bands. It was Quicksand. It was Glenn Cornick's Wild Turkey. Glenn Cornick was the bass player with Jethro Tull. And then it was the Groundhogs and their album Split. They were touring that. And I just thought it sounded awful. Halfway through, I'm looking around thinking, how can anybody listen to this cacophony? And my mate turned to me and said, if you stick your fingers in your ears, it sounds better. So I sat there with my fingers in my ears and it's like, oh yeah, it does. Because the town hall is this great reverbed box and you've got rock music. And in those days, the PAs weren't big and the mix wasn't refined. It was three guys blasting as loud as they could. And what's cool is that over the years, I became friends with the guitarist Tony McPhee, who did change my life and introduced me to the blues and all of that, and he's an extraordinary guitar player.
So what about the gig when it did click, when you were like, oh, okay, this is something that I understand that sounds great. Why aren't I up there?
Well, it sort of happened the other way around. I'd been playing guitar since I was seven, and then at high school, this student teacher called Clifford T. Ward came into our school, and in fact, he was called Cliff Ward, but he had a musical career called Clifford T. Ward. And we gave him such jip and destroyed his lessons so much that he whipped out all these records that he'd recorded. And he inspired us to form a band. And we became, you know, he went on and had like hits with things like Gay and Home Thoughts from Abroad and was a bit of a celebrity in the 70s. But he nurtured us, really. He was our only link with our only link with the music business and pop stardom. But he was the only person that spoke to us. Weirdly, in the village that I come from, on one side of the valley, Geezer Butler from Black Sabbath raised his chickens and came to collect chicken wire in his deluxe roller with the white leather upholstery, dressed like a wizard. And on the other side of the valley, Robert Plant, who still lives there, would send his hairy gardeners in this rusty old American pickup truck to get their chicken wire. So it was a kind of home of rock stars, but you never really saw them much. So Cliff was the only one that really kept me going.
I could be a millionaire if I had the money. I could own a mansion. No, I don't think I'd like that. But I might write a song that makes you laugh. Now that would be funny. And you could tell your friends in England you'd like that. But now I've chosen aeroplanes and boats to come between us. And a line or two on paper wouldn't go amiss. How is Worcestershire? Is it still the same between us? Do you still use television to send you fast asleep? Can you last another week? Does the system still leak? Or have you found a man to mend it? Oh, and by the way, how's your broken heart?
is that mended too? I miss you, I miss you.
Highlife as a genre. Remember the first, because it's something you can hear in the stuff that you've been doing, solo and otherwise.
Yeah.
When did you first get your mind expanded by that?
Highlife. It would be Osibisa, the first album, which I got into because I love the Roger Dean cover.
Yes.
Flying elephants.
Totally.
Yeah. And so I bought it and kind of went, ooh, what's this? But I'd always been, as a kid, I'd been a big fan of funk and Motown, rhythm guitar thing. I couldn't play lead guitar to save my life and still can't. But I love rhythm guitar, and rhythm guitar obviously became that cyclical thing with funk, just repeating the same thing over and over. You know, I got into things like watching the Woodstock films, Sly and the Family Stone and Santana and all of that funk. James Brown, and then along came Osibisa, and then King Sunny a Day and Fela Kuti, and it's just like, of course this is where I belong. And then when electronic dance music came along, for me it was just an extension of exactly the same thing. It was just cycling beats.
Who did you want to be in your sort of mid-teen years?
Anybody but me. Yeah, I had a real problem. I've been writing about it a lot recently, and I just had a horrible teenage time. I've got two teenagers now, and I look at them and go, God, I really would never want to be going through this ever again. It was the worst time of my life. It really was. I didn't know what I wanted to be. I didn't know what to do with my life. I was in a band, and all my mates were out riding their bikes and climbing trees and stuff, and I was loading a van at 1:30 in the morning playing clubs up in Birmingham, and didn't have a clue what I was meant to be, you know?
So was music, I don't know who I am, but I do know this makes me happy.
No, the penny dropped in terms of music when I was about 40, 45. I don't know, week.
I think I've got a career in this.
I know. It's pathetic. I'm a slow learner. I think it was somewhere around the fourth or fifth album. I'm serious.
Really?
Yeah, I'm really serious, yeah. It just kind of went, stop struggling. I think this is what you are, so just do it. Now, I've been to art school and all of that's still part of what I am. And so there's this constant conflict in me of should I be making paintings or should I be in a band? And in the end, it was to just shut up and do it. Yeah. You know, we were in a covers band trying to write original songs and trying to get it off the ground, and we tried and tried and nothing happened. And in that part of the world at that time, you lived life under a bit of a cloud, and you knocked a cup of tea over and it was the end of the world, as opposed to Romford, where, you know, it could be the end of the world and it'd be fine. Just get the kettle on and we'll sort it out. And so we're kind of stuck playing covers and in working men's clubs and village halls for a lot of years. And art school was how I escaped.
Mm-hmm. Actually, tell me about your first impressions of Rick.
I know exactly what they were. I thought, great overcoat. That's all I thought. And I remember we'd... He was a bit of a whiz with electronics. In fact, that's what he was studying at university. And we'd given him an amplifier that had been donated to us by Wayne County. And I can't get it to work, Rick. And he came back a few days later and went, who put these knives and forks in here? I just thought, what a very astute fellow this man is. And what a great overcoat.
Screen Gems, early band. I was listening. Is that your first release?
Yeah.
Because I was listening to Teenage. Yeah. It sounds really good, you know, because often when I do this with people, their first band or their first release isn't sure-footed. Mm. And that sounds... It's got a certain intent to it.
Yeah, it did. It did. We were very... Well, I was very influenced by what was going on at that time. People like Elvis Costello, Nick Lowe, the whole stiff thing that was happening, which was just very exciting. And prior to that, there was a band called the Robert Johnson Band. Not Robert Johnson, the blues player, but if you look him up, fantastic first album, very fast playing. And I had an interim band that played a lot like that, and then the bass player left and he was quite key to it. And then we formed Screen Gems, and I remember making Teenage, and it was one of those classic moments where, and it's happened to Underworld a few times, and Fruit as well, and it was... where you've got the mix up and you've spent all day creating this mix, and then the engineer goes, great, let's mix it, and pulls all the faders down. It's like, oh! And it was never the same again.
I'd rather not talk about this.
You mentioned Fur as well. I mean, that was the first hit.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
Was there a point where did you feel, we have arrived?
Yeah. Absolutely there was. We were, well, we had a number one in Italy, so at that same time we were flying into Italy off the dole and staying in five-star hotels, you know.
Was it really?
It really was.
The discrepancy was that wide?
It was that wide, yeah. We were living in down in the docks in Cardiff, and then we'd get into Air Plastics on the way to London, and we'd get in an aeroplane, and we'd fly to these five-star hotels and have bodyguards and chauffeurs and do these amazing, huge... playback festivals where they play in the big Roman amphitheatres like in Verona and loads of beautiful places, but you're miming in front of thousands of people. It's quite a thing. And we just have the most incredible time out there, eating amazing food, drinking whatever, and it was fantastic. And then we come back home, take the plastics off and get down the dole office.
Is that good for somebody? Because maybe it's a look, we keep our feet on the ground, and artistically, you know, it's going to stop us from believing we're like Mick Jagger. But it's quite a discrepancy.
Yeah, it was...
How did you get on with it?
I didn't get on with it very well at all. The falling down water definitely kicked in at that point. And it, you know, it didn't last that long. But things were going really, really well here. We did a tour with Annie Nightingale opening for us, and which was fantastic. She was DJing and Radio 1 was covering the whole thing, and the record was just steaming out of the shops. Really was, yeah.
And you now recall that quite fondly, it seems.
Yeah, I do. Well, I loved the dressing up. It was great. You know, at that time, there were bands like Echo and the Bunnymen, who great band, but they represented a different state of mind. We had enough of being on the dole and eating beans on toast, and we didn't want to wear black and have have hair over our eyes. And it was so we deliberately wore colours and makeup and pearls and just stuck two fingers up to all of that because we didn't want to be dour. Life was like that anyway. So it was fun. It was fun. You know, we were coming down to places like Camden Palace and hanging out with Rusty Egan and Steve Strange and all of that crew and having a really good time. It was great. way beyond our means. Absolutely, you know, running up enormous debts. And we went out to Germany and we recorded with Connie Plank out there. You know, it was extraordinary, really extraordinary times. Like our dreams had absolutely come true. And in a day, it went horribly wrong.
In a day?
In a day, it did. Yeah.
Can you tell me about that day?
I'll have to read about it in my book, actually.
But it did, and it was no fault of the band's. It was someone thinking they were being a friend, and they weren't. And it just, everything just collapsed on us. And that was that, really.
That's Frere with Doot Doot, featuring Carl Hyde and Rick Smith, who would go on to become Underworld. And that was the duo's first taste of a hit record back in 1983.
This is Six Music.
This is BBC Radio Six Music.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Carl Hyde from Underworld, and that is Underworld's track Crocodile from 2000. Now, one of Carl's biggest early inspirations was 70s Midlands singer Clifford T. Ward, who opened Carl up to another musician who he'd fall in love with, the late, great John Martin.
Cliff was signed to Island Records at the time, and then I remember being in his house and saying that I was collecting albums by guitarists. And he said, "Oh, do you know John Martin?" And he was horrified that I didn't. And at that time, he just put out the Inside Out album, which is a blip in John's catalogue, I think. It's very electronic, very processed, fabulous, just fabulous. And I played it on maximum rotation, that album. And everyone else, of course, was into the kind of folk John Martin. And I was into this, God, I don't know, it was like on another plane, this amazing soundscapes that he was producing from an acoustic guitar, and that blew me away. Because at that time, I'd heard Kraftwerk, and that was something quite extraordinary, Tangerine Dream, and all that German electronic music that was just so far beyond the means of anybody living in Worcestershire on a housing estate. And John Martin comes along, and that's just about graspable, the idea of what he was doing. And then I went to see him perform the album at Birmingham Town Hall, and that was amazing. That really was amazing. Incredibly tragic. I mean, what a voice.
came to me so young and free, put her arms around me. She said that she would always stay with me until my dying day. Grew up in a dirty town where they like to kick you when you're down. If you show an easy side, twist the knife and open it wide. Oh, Hannah, oh, Hannah, oh, Hannah. Remember how you cried when I bought a gun? Never been one to turn and run. Everybody got a hell of a dream. Never make it down the stream. If they cannot chain a fire, though they try to crucify ya. Now I'm out here on the road, thinking about my way back in the past. Stay on your feet in this human race. Think about a lover or a special place. Lost you somewhere down the road. Now I'm here singing when I'm alone. You're the only one make me feel this way. Keep on searching for you every day. Oh, came to me so young and free, put her arms around me. She said that she would always stay with me until the dying day.
First gigs with Underworld Part 2, as is known. They were quite stripped-down affairs, weren't they?
Yeah.
It's almost like sling it in the back of a van.
Yeah, it was definitely sling it in the back of a van.
And do sort of, like, pub circuit attitude, but with this very different kind of music.
Yeah. First gig was in the DJ booth at the Ministry of Sound. See, we used to go to the Ministry a lot, and Darren Emerson, who was in the band then, he'd be DJing, or we'd just go down to check out who was playing. And most nights, they would stop, and then at the other end, there'd be this tiny stage, and somebody would get up and do a PA. And it was horrifying. I thought we'd moved on from that. That was the 1980s, and it was all still happening, and completely killed the vibe. And so that stayed with us, and we discussed this and said, if we were ever to have a band again, wouldn't it be great if we could play those places? But A, not kill the vibe, you know, B, continue the flow, like one DJ segueing into another, as we saw every night there, and also nobody know that you're actually there, because, you know, we'd seen people like Groove Rider in raves and with no lights on him, and thinking, this is strange and fantastic. No one was looking at the stage, and that's what we did that night. We piled our gear up, nobody could actually see us, we played, nobody knew we played, no one stopped dancing, and we afterwards, when people said, I didn't even know you were on, we were going, yes!
That's kind of brilliant.
That's a success. Having said that, Rick and I were left to load the van at 8 a.m. and drive home.
Because you've talked about the moment when you felt Underworld connecting as being Sven Vass.
That was at the Sound Shaft.
Right.
Yeah, where the drum club used to be. When he dropped Skyscraper, I Love You, but he dropped the album version, which I had never believed that would ever be on the dance floor, ever. Rick and Darren had created these DJ mixes, which were specifically for the dance floor, taking out loads of vocal, taking out lots of those indie idiosyncrasies that were all you know, synonymous with that record. But of course, Fenn, who's been a great champion of the band, dropped it that night. Dance floor went mad. We all looked at each other and went, well, well, well. We just skipped a couple of years there of waiting. It was a special moment.
You're a massive Prince fan.
This
has been documented before. When did you first have your moment, your Prince epiphany?
It was being summoned to the headquarters of what was then Tubo Sound, but is now Function One, the big sound system company who've been our mentors for a long, long time. And I think maybe they could just see we were lost. And and they said, you've got to listen to this. And they played Prince's I Want to Be Your Lover. And it messed me up, really, you know, because I hadn't got Prince at all back in the days when we were working with Connie Plank. Connie was a massive Prince fan, and that would have been around about the time of Dirty Mind and Controversy and all of that. And to me, it was just all a bit too weedy and thin. I was rock, you know. I'd finally given in on trying to follow Tamla and reggae and as a kid and gone over to rock. So I didn't get Prince until they sat us down and made us listen to that one track. And then I became obsessive about it, to the detriment of our music, really.
Really?
Yeah, because then Underworld Mark I became this very, 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 very sub Prince funky pop group thing. Yeah.
What's the Prince track we should play?
Well, that would be a lover. It's great. I spent 6 weeks out there, Paisley Park.
How was it?
It was astonishing. I was MDing another project And so he was rehearsing every day next to our studio, and we'd, you know, meet in the kitchen, have a cup of tea. But the one night, Miles Davis came in and played at his club, Glam Slam. And I'd seen Miles at Wembley, where he'd played with his back to the audience, not that long before. And, of course, he was there with, and Prince was in the audience, so he played facing the audience. And we were, like, just a few feet away from Miles. That in itself was something else. And the only thing he said was, "Prince! Prince! Prince!" And the engineers were back at the studio setting up the recording for them to get together, because the story was that last time he'd come through town, they'd recorded together. And so we were all invited to this jam session, and Miles just wasn't feeling very well, so it didn't happen. I can't tell you how gutted we were.
God. Second Toughest in the Infants was a record that propelled things to a different stratosphere.
I love that record. It's the two albums that I like the most are the first and the second albums. They were brothers and sisters. They were came off the same role, really. It was Rick was definitely flying when he was making those records, pulling stuff out of thin air. You know, for me, it was an incredibly dark time. It was the height of my destructive living, and the lyrics are all there. And so I was going through them on the train coming in today, and looking at them, going, "Oh my God! Oh gee! Oh wow! Whenever we perform an Underworld track from that era, I'm right back there. It just all comes back.
That's tough.
Well, it's not too bad, because now I kind of go, "Sure, but I'm not there now. Still here."
We've obviously got to ask you about Born Slippy, because if we're going to talk about your career, we have to. Is it Born in the USA for the next generation, in the way that that song was seized upon by people as being America, and it wasn't about that? Do you think that Born Slippy, in a way, kind of go, "Oh, there's the chant, and that's what it's about," and you're kind of, "Well, actually, the imagery in there is a lot richer and a lot more subtle and romantic than actually you're getting." Yeah. Did you feel a bit like, "Oh, you're kind of missing the point, people"?
Oh, definitely. At the time.
The analogy works.
Yeah. Now it's something else.
Yeah,
of course it's something else. But at the time it was horrific for me, because...
Powerful word to use.
Yeah, it was a cry for help for me. It was a great groove that Rick had created, blew me away, and I had to sing to it. And that lyric just came out in one. In fact, he chopped out a chunk of it that's never been heard. It's actually not very good. So I heard it the other day and went, "That was a really good edit, Rick." And then he bookended it with those beautiful chords, which he's you know, phenomenal with. But for me, it was a cry for help. You know, I'd had enough. A lot of that first album was a cry for help, and quite a big chunk of the second album, because I was writing stuff that I was doing and worlds that I was inhabiting, in the hope that somebody would get the message that this...
"Come and get you."
Yeah, "Can you get me out of this, please?" And of course, when we performed Born Slippy for the first time, the cans went up in the air, and it was, "Oh God, that's the antithesis of what I'm trying to get at here. That's what I'm drowning in." I mean, these days it's great, isn't it? It's become an anthem for people who are having a good time. It's become synonymous with celebration of positivity, as far as I can see.
Yeah, absolutely.
And all of that is a long, long time ago. What is fantastic for me is how it's transcended that darkness, and it's become something about good times.
The lights are going down.
Oh, God.
On the Olympic Stadium.
Mama, the lights, I don't want to die.
All about to start. How do you feel?
I have to say, it's all about Rick. I played very little part in that. It was Rick's gig. He wanted to do it, and he did an amazing job. Mm-hmm. He almost put his life on the line for that, as he often does, put his heart and soul to the detriment of his physical health. He did an astonishing job there. The thing that made me most proud about what he did there was that all the doubters that I knew, all the well-reads of the world who were tutting, phoned me up afterwards and went, well, oh God, I hate to admit this, but that was really good. I think that's testament to both Rick and Danny's vision. It was a stroke of genius to put Danny in that place.
It's become a part of folklore, I think.
As soon as that combination was put together, you just knew it was going to be good. We'd worked with him on Frankenstein at the National Theatre before that, and realised when he got us in to the office and we saw the models and all the plans for the Olympics, it was clear where it was going and that Frankenstein was an audition for the Olympics.
Think about it like that, right.
Yeah, but Rick did an amazing, amazing job, yeah. One of the good things that happened about the Olympics was Rick has always taken a back seat and still does. You know, God bless him. He's just like, Rick. People don't really know what Rick does and the extent of his influence and how important what he does is to our careers, my life. With the Olympics, a lot of people got to see what a good man he is, what a decent man he is, and how much he cares and loves the people that he works with. And I felt great. It was good to be remove myself from that situation because I always take the limelight.
There's a lot of love there, isn't there?
There is now.
Well, there must be because there is a new record.
Yeah, there is.
Is it like you just find yourself gravitating? You can't. It's like magnets. You have to work together.
I wasn't sure that there would be another record. We'd spent quite a bit of time apart. We'd done other things, you know, since the Olympics. He'd worked with Danny and I'd done other records. It was touch and go for a while, I'll be honest. And
what made it touch rather than go?
35 years of being together, frustrations, the things that any couple of brothers would feel towards each other. Yeah, just little grudges that build up into big grudges, and we sorted it out. And wow, did we sort it out? It was astonishing.
What happened?
What happened is behind closed doors. But what the result of that was that he is for sure my best mate. Working with him is the highlight of my week, absolute, without question, and it still is. And we turned up on the day one of the record. And it was polite. It was like, how is this going to go? And, we finished the end of the day and it was like, oh, wow, that was really good. We turned up with the right attitude, with the right heads on. And it carried on like that day after day after day after day. No pressure, no compromise. We were clear to just be brothers and make music. I love being with him. I love hanging out with him. I love being on stage with him. I love being in the studio with him, having a cup of tea with him, and just really enjoy his company.
And the final thing we ask all, I guess, is to pick the last track.
Crikey, you got me there. You got me there. Do you know what? I really want to do this. Gay by Clifford T. Ward.
As a bit of a tip of the hat.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. If it wasn't for Cliff, then I wouldn't be sat here.
It's good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
You too.
Gay. Won't you let me have a say in the way you've been?
Six Music.
Rightfully, yeah. The time.
morning at 11.
Keris Matthews.
At 8.
Radcliffe and McConie.
BBC Radio
6 Music.
Right now, it's Chris Hawkins.
You just drive your cold, cause one monkey don't stop the show. Little Mary's bad. In these streets she done ran ever since when the heat began. I told a girl, look here, calm down, I'ma hold your hand to enable you to beat the plan, cause you was quick to learn. And we can make money to burn if you allow me the latest game. I don't ask for much, but enough room to spread my